Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the newly renovated blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in the history of humanity. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
Excellent, man. Hey, I got to tell you, the newly renovated blog, it rocks. I'm very, very pumped about some of the new features and how good it looks. It's I got to compliment you on that. You did the heavy lifting on all those renovations, and it looks great.
Well, since no one else has said anything specifically, I want to just say that the S in Speculist has never been cooler than it is now. Okay? We have really upgraded. I mean, this is, I don't know if you know, that's like a Hubble photograph of a galaxy that I just skewed a little and just angled just a little bit, and it became the perfect letter S. I was just kind of proud of how that worked out. So, but yeah, from the letter S on down, it's a complete makeover for the site. We're on a wider page. We are supporting a number of Web 2.0 functions that were long overdue. We've got commenting back online. People are able to leave comments from their Google, Yahoo accounts, from Facebook, any number of different ways of logging into it. We've got a tag cloud. We've got a Google Friends group. All kinds of fun stuff going on the site. So if you haven't been by lately, come on by and check out the new and improved Speculist. We're pretty psyched about it, and most psyched of all, of course, about the content, which we continue to keep pushing out there.
That's right. Keep it rolling. And on a selfish note, I love the Twitter feed there in the side margin. And
this way we got your tweets coming at us instantly. They're instantly part of the blog. You can still do your roundups, or you can still take those in individual tweets and blow them up into full blog posts at your leisure. But you never have to worry about whether your tweets are making it to the Speculist. They're getting there in real time now. So, yeah, that's pretty cool. Also, I'll just mention that widget that has the Twitter feed on it. It has two tabs, and the tab on the left is Steve, and the tab on the right is the Speculist. That's my Twitter feed. I don't update as often, so that's why I gave Steven kind of the pole position. And I might take that, and I might turn that into two side-by-side widgets. Actually, it would look pretty cool with our colors, one in purple and one in black, one with the Speculist and one with short attention span blogging. Anyway, we're still, you know, we got a lot of time here. We can continue to experiment with it and make it into what we like. And we appreciate, listener comments on what they think is working and what they'd like to see.
Excellent.
Well, we got a big show tonight, Stephen, but before we do anything else, today is an extremely special day. Do you have any idea what today is?
Am I missing
I'll give you a hint. I'll give you a huge hint. It's somebody's birthday.
It's somebody's birthday. Well, it's not yours.
Not mine.
Yours has passed recently. So it's not mine.
No, but someone closely connected to this show.
Is it PJ's or Fowler's?
First guess.
Or,
very good. Well done. PJ Manning.
Oh, PJ. PJ Manning.
29
years tonight.
Old. She's highly
and
accomplished young lady. And we wish her a very happy birthday. Now, I have to tell you what I did, Stephen. Foolishly, in a moment of, kind of birthday greeting enthusiasm, I wrote on PJ's wall, that you and I would sing happy birthday to her tonight on the show.
Oh, boy.
And
oh, boy.
I think you realize that something written on someone's wall in Facebook is as close to a blood oath as it gets today. I think you understand that. And because you
well,
are my co-host,
I am
allowed to commit you to this. I believe that's understood. Right?
Well, here as the other co-host, though, can I make a recommendation that perhaps we should wait until after the music rolls or towards the end of the program, not front load this disaster of us singing happy birthday. I mean, you know.
I really think we should get it over with. I think it'll just be hanging there otherwise if we don't do it. So, also, it won't be that bad. Don't worry. Yeah, we'll get it going here. Okay, you ready?
Right,
happy birthday
to you.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy
birthday,
dear
PJ. It's like it's a round. What's going on here?
Happy birthday to you. Okay, and many more.
And
all right, we got that out of the way. So
I think we've got a half second delay between us or something.
Perhaps so, because you were waiting, and then I was hearing myself sing without you, and oh well.
No, I started first. Oh yeah, that's interesting. So
yeah.
I don't know. Anyone in the chat room responding to this in any way, or they've all left at this point?
Sally is suggesting that we synchronize. but
we were trying. That was our best attempt. Seriously though, everyone. I think everyone's glad that we were, you know, done with that, and so
yeah.
we can now move on with the rest of the program. We do wish you a happy birthday, PJ. Sorry that we weren't able to express it in a more synchronized way. I guess is kind of the missing term there. So anyhow. Hey, let me give an update on our project to get 1,000 people to read The Rational Optimist. Now, I believe this time last week we had said, what, 10, 11, 12, something like that?
Yeah, I was expecting maybe a dozen at the most, you know, which means we'll have to live forever to get to that 1,000. But anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, we were at about a dozen last week, and tonight we are at, let me double check my spreadsheet, 37. So
we
have moved along tremendously. We have 58 members on the Facebook group. And if you're listening and you're on Facebook and haven't joined the group yet, it's called Let's Get 1,000 People to Read The Rational Optimist. So please join the group. But joining the group isn't enough. You then need to write on the wall or send me a message or somehow otherwise convey to me that you are reading it, have read it, or are sharing it. And if you're sharing it, give me a name so that I can list that person on the list too, because some of the items on the list are like, you know, Dave's family member, right? I've got two down here that are like Marvin Lewis, son one, Marvin Lewis, son two. Awesome, Marvin, that you shared the book with your sons. Need those names so that we kind of complete that out. But actually, one of the very cool things that that we've seen here in the early days of this, because really the program is just about 10 days old. I started it Monday. Of last week. Well, I had sent the books out prior to that, but I only started promoting it on Facebook and on the blog about 10 days ago. People reporting ideas such as, well, I'm going to share this book with my kids. And, Stephen, in fact, that's your plan.
Yeah. I just absolutely thought that the book is just slam full with ideas, and a lot of these ideas are kind of they run counter to mainstream thought in a lot of ways. And so, to me, that's the essence of good intellectualism. Is that when you know it's out there, it gives ideas that it doesn't really care, you know, that it might be uncool as long as it's true. And so, I guess that's the best way of putting it. It's some good stuff there. And so I'm going to share it with the kids.
It's a terrific book, and I think it's a great book for kids. I think it's a young people of all ages will appreciate the message of The Rational Optimist, because I think before that veneer of cynicism takes hold, people can respond, or you know, some of us fight it our whole lives. But before that gets a hold of somebody, I think younger minds are more generally more willing to accept a picture of the world that maybe it's not so bleak, that maybe there is a positive spin. And I like what you said about the kind of going against the grain. And in fact, that is our that is our theme this evening. That's the topic that we're going to be dealing with. Actually, inspired by a piece that I put on the blog about the progress we've made so far with the Let's Get 1,000 People to Read the Rational Optimist group. Before I go there, I just want to remind everyone listening, if you have bought the book, are reading it, have given it to someone, have loaned it to someone, and haven't told us about it yet, you can leave a comment at the blog. You can join the Facebook group and write on the wall there or start a discussion there or send me a message. Inviting me to be your friend if we're not already friends, and we should already be friends. But one way or another, let me know you're out there so that we can add you to the list so that Sally points out we're at about 4%, and that's really not too shabby at all 10 days in. We'll see where we are with this time next week. I feel like one thing I wanted to point out, Stephen, was I feel like I'm about five things away from having tried all the different things I know how to try. So it could be by about a week from today, by next week's show, we might be brainstorming, well, what do we do next to get this idea?
We're in a blend.
I did a blog post, okay, I did a Facebook group, and I'm doing regular updates to the Facebook group, and I'll keep coming back to the blog post. And, of course, we'll keep coming back, and we will talk about it on this program every week until we hit 1,000 or until we go so far beyond 1,000 that we have to talk about other things. And we got insta-launched today, so that that kind of cascades and puts it out there too. So you start thinking, well, what are the other things we can do? We'll ask everyone to kind of park that question. Just let that sort of simmer. Give yourself some time to think about that. And this time next week, we might come back with additional ideas. But the first thing you can do, if you haven't done it already, is let me know what you're doing. If you're reading it, if you're sharing it, let me know so we can make you part of the list. Okay.
And if you're doing so as a result of our gentle goading, I think that's key too. I mean, that is
key. Although at this point, I think the Facebook group is kind of growing into, if somebody says, I was reading it and now I'm sharing it with my children. Do I just count the person who? Do I just count the children? Do I count the person? I kind of feel like. It's not so much whether I got them to do it, but the fact that we're going to be 1,000 people reading the book. I feel like that's probably the most important thing.
All right.
But I don't know. The rules – I'm not trying to be too loosey-goosey with the rules. We do want it to be, not somebody who read it like 6 months ago and suddenly we add them to the list or something like that. It needs to be part of this kind of wave of momentum that we've got going. Okay, so we're going to talk about – stating the obvious, and I had this great quote from one of my favorite blogs, Less Wrong. This is a blog where, among other folks, Patrick Friedman blogs there. This fellow who goes under the name Evain, his name is actually Scott Alexander Siskind. He's the person whose blog post we were actually quoting there, and of course Eliezer Yudkowsky. It's a group blog, and there's a bunch of these kind of heavyweight intellectual types writing very interesting posts. And as I was putting together my message around the rational optimist, I just happened to follow a link on Facebook from Wayne Rudinsky quoting this piece on Less Wrong. And here's the quote that just jumped out at me and got my attention, and it was this. So my hypothesis is that if a certain side of an issue has very obvious points in support of it, and the other side of an issue relies on much more subtle points that the average person might not be expected to grasp, then adopting the second side of the issue will become a signal for intelligence, even if that side of the argument is wrong. And I think that's brilliant. I've never seen that formula put together in that formula before, but I think that's exactly right. I believe that that he's really nailed something there.
Well, we've taken note of this probably, and we expressed it probably a little less artfully on the Speculist, or actually probably on Fast Forward Radio before, where we basically said, just because an idea has you know, some clout, out in the world, does not necessarily mean it's always absolutely true. Sometimes optimism is just not cool. That doesn't mean necessarily that optimism is wrong. And we've kind of had a conversation over that before, and I think that's kind of what it comes down to. You know, sometimes being all pessimistic and everything is taken as, being realistic about the future, when that's not necessarily the truth at all.
That's exactly right. Yeah, well, I mean, and there's a part of that which is that if, you know, people want to avoid disappointment, they want to avoid getting their hopes up, they want to avoid looking silly by getting all enthusiastic about things that don't work out. So that all factors in.
It's a rare thing it's a rare thing that somebody is made to feel silly for being a pessimist when things turn out great. You know?
That's right, because everybody's happy that things turned out great.
Yeah, everybody's great. Hey, yay, something great happened, and they forget that, you know, over here this highly respected, you know, and intelligentsia over here has basically been preaching pessimism for years. They're not made to feel silly for that. But the people that even the people that predicted the great outcome are still thought to be, you know, just blind optimists. Oh well, depends on what kind of life you want to lead, I guess.
Well, I've got a little snippet from Matt Ridley. I'm going to read right at the end that I think really kind of sums that whole idea up. But let's look a little deeper at this notion that that the obvious is wrong. There's something more subtle, pretty much the opposite of what seems to be obviously true, that's right, and it is a signal. It is a sign, a mark of intelligence. To have adopted that second view. Now, what Evain points out here is that it's a signal of intelligence, even if you're wrong. But that doesn't mean that it's always wrong. Sometimes it is true, and that's where the perception that going against the grain and going against the obvious means that you're smart comes from. And I've got two examples of them, one very obvious example and one that I think really kind of epitomizes it for me in my own life. And the most basic fundamental example is the notion of the Earth circling the sun rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
Right? The obvious thing happening here is the sun is passing overhead every day, right? And so people believed that for many years. Others looked more closely and saw some subtle things and said, no, that's not right. Something else is happening here, and what's happening here is quite the opposite of what you think is happening. So, and they were right. The obvious thing was false, and the subtle thing turned out to be true. So that's my crowning example. Do you have any examples that you can think of, Stephen, of when it works out correctly?
I've got a pretty good example, a counterexample, but we haven't gotten to that yet.
If you have one where it did work, it's okay.
Pretty much any scientific idea that's overturned would fall into that category. I mean, wouldn't it? I mean, The great minds of the 19th century pretty much accepted as fact that heavier-than-air flight for humans was simply not possible, that we could not produce an engine that would provide enough power to allow it.
And it was obvious that things like iron and wood couldn't float in the air. I mean, right? It was obvious that was the case, yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, and look, they note that the engines were getting more and more powerful for the amount of weight that they had all the time, until it reached a point where the Wright brothers were able to get off the 1902. So that was, that's another obvious example. And pretty much, the progress of science is exactly what you're talking about, where it turns out that the obvious truth was incorrect. So
exactly.
My other example
is more mundane than that. I think you really hit the nail on the head with that one, because that is kind of the grand sweeping example, and it shows why that notion of going against the grain, that notion of rejecting the obvious in favor of more subtle, is associated with intelligence, because so much progress, so much intellectual progress has rested on that idea. So that makes my second example all the more mundane. When your car goes into a skid and you're sliding into a bank, which way do you turn the wheel?
Just opposite of what you would
exactly. You got to turn into the skid to regain control of the vehicle. The obvious thing is to try to turn the vehicle away from the direction that you're skidding, and of course that makes it that much worse, and can't regain control of the vehicle.
Also, the obvious thing is, well, I want to stop the vehicle, so let me just slam on the brake.
There you go.
Hold
that
brake
exactly.
To the brake of the floor.
Right.
That's not the thing to do either.
The obvious thing to do is that, and that is completely wrong. You have to do more subtle things. You have to turn into the skid. You have to pump the brakes. There's these subtle things that are actually correct. So what Evain calls this principle, this mistaken practice, I should say, of believing something to be true just because it's the opposite of the obvious thing, accepting something as a subtle truth simply because you're smart to reject what's obviously true. The moniker he has given this is pretending to be wise, and those of us brought up going to Sunday school recognize that as Romans 1:22, pretending to be wise, they became fools. So it's a bad direction to go in, Evain is saying, and I have to agree with that. I tend to think of it as turning away from the skid. That's how I would describe it, because that's what they're doing. They're thinking they're doing something clever, and they're actually going to get themselves in a lot of trouble. So let's talk about some examples of some of the counterexamples. You said you had one. So what's an example of an obvious truth that turns out actually to be obviously true and the subtle opposite is not true?
Well, an obvious truth is that capitalism enriches whatever country adopts it. And there are a lot of people that don't like capitalism, and they see the problems associated with capitalism. Not everybody gets wealthy. If you allow people the freedom to try, you know, all kinds of weird stuff, some people are going to lose all their money and they'll be poor. And those who are not gifted may never have a lot of money. They may be poor all their life because they lack the gifts to succeed in a capitalistic system. And so they see those problems, and therefore they say, well, capitalism is just unfair, it's a bad system, and fail to realize that it's probably there is no better system for enriching more people than capitalism. So a higher percentage of the population, I guess, is a better way to put that. So that's the Ayn Rand example.
Well, that's an interesting one. Actually, if you read the whole piece that I linked, one of the things that the author does, which is very interesting, is he actually extends this to even a third step, that sometimes there is a stated position which may or may not be true, then its opposite, which may or may not be true, and then like a third, even more subtle take on what appeared to be the obvious one in the first place. And I don't have time to go into the whole argument behind that, but the example he actually gives there is conservative over on the far end of the spectrum, which is countered by liberal, which is then countered by libertarian. So
he leans towards that. Being
it's interesting. He has an essay. If you read his stuff, he has an essay called "Why I'm Not a Libertarian," which starts out explaining why he is and then tells why he isn't. It's really interesting stuff. But your example of capitalism kind of put me in mind of that. It's like, well, you start out with this one thing, and then you have its opposite, and that seems more subtle and more refined, but it's not quite right. And then you opposite it again, but you don't end up in the same place where you started, and you've got something, even maybe more compelling at that point. But I think that's a strong example that you make there. And I would say that from the standpoint of the things we typically talk about on this show, it's the triumph of bottom up over top down, generally.
Exactly.
That when you make people, when you allow people to be free, when you allow people to choose their own destiny, to control their own well-being, that they do well with that, and that they do better with that than if you impose their well-being upon them. I think that's my that is a basic tenet of how the world works that I've come to accept over the years. And I think there are a lot of people who believe that people are better off having their best interest imposed upon them. And
that's right.
Indeed, I think that belief probably is considered to be the more subtle, more sophisticated view, as opposed to the obvious thing, which is, well, let people do what they want because then they'll be happy, right? Which seems, pretty straightforward. They've got arguments against that, and then maybe there's a third position that says, well, maybe there's something else even beyond that. But I think that's a great one to get the ball rolling here with us today. Let's go back to some of the others that we talked about on the list. Oh, actually, before we do, I've got some Will Brown, our good buddy, who posts over there at wheretheresawilliam.blogspot.com, was kind enough. He can't be with us in the chat room tonight, but he was kind enough to send some thoughts about this formulation. And he writes the following. He takes a snippet from the "Then adopting the second side of this issue will become a signal for intelligence, even if that side of the argument is wrong." And he says, "If the side of an argument adopted is ultimately wrong, and therefore the argument fails on its own merits, is it really the contention that failure equals, quote, a signal for intelligence? Even stipulating that a qualified form of intelligence might legitimately be argued, that's still not the claim being advanced above. I do not think intelligence necessarily equates to ethical or moral, and reject failure as a metric for measuring intelligence." Well, this is why it's always dangerous to take stuff out of its context. And in fact, let me just swing back up here and put that quote back into its context, and I think that answers that question, because that's a fair question, right? How intelligent are you if you end up being wrong? Well, to your point earlier, Stephen, it seems that if you're wrong about saying things are bad when they turn out to be good, nobody ever nails you on it. But I do want to give Evain his fair due here. Oh, now I can't find it. Anyway, I was going to read it, but
nothing that William said that we disagree with. You and I both would say that intelligence does not equal ethical or moral, and that's not what was being said.
Yeah,
that's
really not the point at all. That is a plausible conclusion from just reading that snippet, and that's really not where he's going. It's certainly not where we're going.
Right.
In fact, I found it. So he writes, "Then adopting the second side of the issue will become a signal for intelligence, even if that side of the argument is wrong." And then he goes on to say, "This only works in issues which are so muddled to begin with that there's no fact of the matter, or where the fact of the matter is difficult to tease out." So this only works while these matters are still in contention. No one is going to claim intelligence for believing something opposite of the truth. So I think that's an important distinction to make, and it wasn't clear from just that snippet of a quote. So I appreciate Will pointing that out so that we were able to make that quick clarification. Okay, so now I've got some, I think, obvious statements, and let's discuss these here. The appearance of humanity on this planet was a good thing. Now I've listed these as true or false, but Stephen, if you're more comfortable, you can just agree or disagree with these statements.
I agree, absolutely.
Okay, why?
And why? Yeah, okay.
There's an essay portion to all these questions. I know.
I would say that intelligence is a good thing, and the more intelligence that is present in the environment is good. And so, although there are actually people out there that argue that we're not the most intelligent creatures on this planet, although dolphins are awesome and chimps are great and all this, I've never seen a building or a painting are a bridge built by any of those creatures. Humanity coming to this planet or being placed here or whatever it was a good thing. The rising of humanity on this planet is a good thing. So.
I think you make a pretty good argument, but let me take the counter just for a moment. I'll be devil's advocate here for a moment, and I'm going to take the prosecution position on humanity. Okay, the planet would be better off without humanity, and let me tell you why. Okay, humanity pollutes the planet, ravages the surface of the planet, takes mountains and knocks them down, and deforests the planet and causes mass extinction and causes mass suffering among the creatures that live there. Humanity does nothing but create misery on this planet for all the other living things that are here. So actually, their appearance on this planet was not a good thing. Only you humanocentric, enjoying your little human life could have this idea that. That it was good for humanity to appear. Actually, it was a disaster. It was a catastrophe for this planet for humanity to appear.
All right, Agent Smith.
it's the smell, okay?
Yeah. I can't stand the smell.
It's the smell.
I tell you, I always find it interesting to hear that argument voiced by actual humans. because there are people that really, really believe that. Phil, I know you're taking the point of there are real live human beings walking around believing that have yet to commit suicide.
Right.
And I think that's the bottom line. They please understand. If you hold these beliefs, do not commit suicide. I'm not suggesting that you do, but I'm suggesting that is the ultimate. That's where you kind of go with that.
Right. Well, either you're going to be the human who rectifies all this, or you need to go live a very simple life someplace. For one thing, you shouldn't be arguing this on the internet. Right? Think of all the power you're drawing and living in your house.
Exactly. Go live with the Amish or something, man.
Yeah.
They'll accept that view,
Exactly.
But,
let me give you my argument, because actually I think in our correspondence with Will, he had some thoughts on that too, which I thought were kind of interesting. He said the appearance of humanity on this planet was a good thing for humanity. Okay, so that's not quite the rant I went into, but it's more of it was good for us, but maybe not so great for the rest of the planet. But actually, no, I don't agree. I think that our appearance on this planet was a good thing for the planet, ultimately a good thing for the other living things on this planet and for the planet itself. And in addition to the fact that it's good for the history of the universe, because intelligence is an excellent thing for the universe to have coughed up. The increasing orders of complexity that were enabled by the aging of the universe, going from simpler elements to more complex elements, going from base metals to organic chemistry to eventually life emerging, and from simple life to more complex life to finally intelligent life. This is a good progress, okay? And to reach a species that's able to some extent, a much less extent than we think, but to some extent understand all that, to grasp that process and ultimately have it in our power to participate consciously in that process, to move that process in the next direction, is a wonderful thing. It's a payoff for the entire planet. We've been hard on the planet. It's no excuse, but other species are hard on the planet too. You actually, before the show started, we were talking about this, and you gave a great example of that. If you could reiterate that, I would appreciate it.
Well, very early in the history of our planet, a form of life arose that was expelling a toxic gas that just about ended life on this planet, and that toxic gas was oxygen. It was just about the end of everything. But fortunately, other organisms arose that was able to use oxygen, and in fact, oxygen turned out to be a corrosive gas. That's true, and that's part of the things that our bodies fight through the aging process. So we basically are rusting or corroding to death. But I guess my point is, though, that it turns out that there's a high energy content that can be used within oxygen, and so it turns out that a very robust forms of life can that use oxygen could arise, and then there sort of a balance was reached, between those who emitted carbon dioxide and those who emitted oxygen.
So that these dangerous new organisms that showed up and caused untold destruction ultimately
just about killing the planet.
Yeah, just about wiped the planet out. In some ways caused more destruction than we've even dreamed about doing, although we've done our share, turn out to be the means by which life becomes more complex, more robust, more interesting, more diverse. It's a net good thing. Not to say that species going extinct in and of itself is good. Not to say that animal suffering is good. Those are not good things. And things being killed are not inherently good things. In fact, I believe death sucks is one of my obviously true things we'll be encountering here in just a few minutes. But what it is to say is that the tragic, catastrophic tendency of some species to cause other species suffering and to go extinct is not unique to humanity. It didn't originate with us. It originated elsewhere in the development cycle. Here's what's unique to us, as far as we know. Humanity is the only species that has ever tried to preserve other species from going extinct.
Yeah.
As far as we know, we're the only species that even has a concept of species. Right, we're the only ones.
Or what death means? Yeah, I mean that's you know, you talk about the basically what the human condition is. We are the animal that understands what death is, and I know other animals are experience fear and things like that, but we really grasp it at a very young age.
Yeah,
and so
we value them in a way that they don't or can't value us. To suggest that it was bad for us to be here is to suggest that it was bad for them, these other species, to have someone on the planet who values them. We're also the only species that thinks about things like, how do we protect the planet from getting hit by a meteor?
Yeah.
How do we protect the planet from getting hit by cosmic rays?
Yeah.
Yeah,
watch Deep Impact or Armageddon. It might be a big deal one day. Anyway.
Yeah.
I want to throw in this one idea. I think there are really basically two flavors of environmentalism that are kind of at war with one another, okay? There's the old Judeo-Christian idea that the planet is basically given to us as humans, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That it's that we are, it's part of our dominion or whatever is to take charge of the planet and to be good stewards of the planet.
Right.
In other words, don't go just completely destroy the, it may be yours to have, but don't go destroy it. We only have one planet. Okay.
Right.
Then there's another form of environmentalism that sort of says, the planet is, basically, humans should be here to serve the planet. And if the planet is, has this need or that need or whatever, humans should should be secondary to that. Human needs, human desires, human wants should be secondary to anything that the planet might want. And there are actually people that anthropomorphize the planet, in a way, and think of it almost as a person. I think those two flavors of environmentalism are a bit at war with one another. And I guess what I'm coming down on the side of is say, I think it's better and more productive to look at the planet as something that we should be good stewards of, make sure that we're not, you know, completely destroying it for the next generation, or that, and that we're taking care of it so that, you know, we're able to enjoy it more. And so,
No, I was going to say, what I like about the steward model is that it represents a positive relationship between us and the planet, which I think is right. To me, the division line is elsewhere. I see it somewhat different. I see what you're saying, but here's where I see the division actually occurring.
Okay.
Is it's between those who view this kind of dualist divide between humanity and nature, and those who recognize that we're part of it.
I see exactly. Yeah, we're something outside of it, that we're a plague on the system or something, is to completely misunderstand where we are.
Right.
Hoover builds
a dam and it's cool, right? You know, we build Hoover Dam and we raped the planet, right? why? You know, it's like we just did what the beavers did better, right? I mean, we did a really cool version of what the
beavers
did.
Take a look at Hoover Dam and they go, golly, that's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think there is this reverence towards nature that stops short of recognizing that, hey, if not the crowning glory, we are a key part of nature. Nature decided to vest intelligence, or God, however you want to look at it, in us. So we're the part of nature that thinks about nature. We're the part of nature that reveres nature, for crying out loud. So to make us like the bad guys in that story is insane.
This nature. So yeah, get off your high horse. It's almost a weird form of self-defeating narcissism.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
the opposite of narcissism is. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know what that is, who that mythical figure would be, but that's exactly right. Yeah, it's like having
a
narcissistic inferiority complex.
Didn't want to look in the mirror.
That's right. He couldn't stand his own reflection. So good. I think we've taken this one much farther than we needed to, but we had fun with it.
It was a good rabbit hole to go running down. So yeah. Okay. So what's the next one?
We've got several more of these, so let's keep moving on. The next one is life is getting better, and we both strongly agree with this one. Before we run out of time, I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to jump straight to the Matt Ridley quote, because this was from his blog, and I just thought this was so great. He says, "If you write a book saying the world is getting better, you might get away with being thought eccentric. But if you write a book saying that the world is going to go on getting better and that in 2100 people will be healthier, wealthier, and wiser and have more rainforests, too, you will be thought stark, raving bonkers. It is just not sane to believe in a happy future for people and their planet. Yet, I cannot stop myself. I've looked at all the statistics, facts, anecdotes, predictions, and pronouncements I can get a hold of, and they all seem to me to suggest that we will be better off in 2100 than we are now. Much better off. Global warming, I hear you say. Yes, indeed. The official forecasts say world temperatures will rise by 2 to 4 degrees Celsius in this century. It is going to have to start accelerating soon because the rate of increase since 1980 is about 1 degree Celsius per century. And that's if you ignore the satellites and rely mainly on land surface records, which many now think are hopelessly contaminated with the effects of urbanization. Even then, it has been slowing down. Moreover, the very same official forecasts also say that global per capita income will multiply by 4 to 16 times in the same period. And the higher the temperature, the higher the income. Seriously, go look at the numbers. That's what they say. The warmer we get, the richer we will get, or rather, the other way around. In which case, what exactly is the problem?" Now, I'll provide the link, and you can read the whole thing, but he goes on in that vein, dispelling one major reason why we're going to be unhappy in the future after another, but it's terrific reading. And, of course, I think we don't have to spend a lot of time on refuting the idea that the world's going to get worse in the future, just because that's all we talk about. I mean, that's primarily what we talk about
yeah.
on this show.
If you really want to hear it, check out our archives. We've got several years' worth of talking about that now.
I believe we've touched on it here and there over the last 3 years. So it's available in the blog and on the website. So we won't spend too much time on that one, but I think it's an excellent example of that which is really pretty obviously true if you look at the facts. If you look at where people have been, where they are now, it's obvious that life is getting better, but it is absolutely perceived to be the more serious, more intellectual view of the world to think that things are about to go to hell in a handbasket. Okay, so our next one, death sucks. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah.
Am I being too hard on poor old death?
No. Death sucks. And we are the, and here's another example of how we're different. We think it really grasps how much it sucks. You know, I mean, we can lose a loved one and 30 years later still miss that person.
Yes.
You know, name one other creature on the planet that can grieve a loss that long. You know, it's, you know, I think it comes down to, in part, that, you know, how intelligent we are and how, by comparison to the other creatures on the planet, that, you know, you basically, getting to know someone and being close to someone, you adapt to them. I mean, your brain, in a way, works in cooperation with the person who's close to you. And when that person is taken away, and I'm being very impersonal about this in this description, but when that person is taken away, in a way, a part of you, quite literally, has been taken away.
That's right.
We're cooperative. We are cooperative animals, and we live in groups. And you take a person away, and it's and quite literally, a part of you has been taken away. And that loss, many years. And so, yeah, there's not much that can be said positive about that experience. But I don't know. Am I saying anything wrong there, Phil?
No. You know what? I think you really hit the nail on the head with that. It's hard on the person it happens to, and it's hard on the people who get left behind. It is. This horror that we've had to deal with since the beginning of our existence, and we've rationalized ourselves into saying, well, there's nothing we can do about it, therefore it's a good thing, which I believe Aubrey de Grey said when he was on the program about a year ago, that it pretty much comes down to that,
we're usually in agreement that death sucks for someone who's, say, you know, if the young mother of you know, three kids passes away of cancer or something, then that's awful. That's terrible, you know, and it is. That's awful. She had young children. Oh, what are they going to do now? That poor family. But, you know, it's also awful when someone who is 90 years old passes. It's just that we kind of expect it's going to happen very soon, and so, you know, create that expectation that's, you know, and we may arrange our affairs, you know, that's sort of a euphemism there, but it's around the fact that person will die. But, you know, when that person goes, that's still, I mean, you know, that's an individual. They have, you know, it's a person who has value, and we lose that person, and all the history they have and the person they were is gone. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah,
I remember the Memorial Day show. We talked about the fact that we're probably now losing World War II vets at about the same rate we were during World War II.
Yeah.
And then that was considered, you know, this huge devastating loss, which of course it was. And now it's considered, well, that's really sad. You know, it's like it's the same number of people dying, you know. It's the same cohort. And yet, we almost have to look at it differently. But my point is, we don't have to look at it differently, and we have to really start seeing it differently than we've seen it in the past. Now, I had a great comment about this from our old buddy M. Simon, and he wrote, "I like death, and I think it's a very good thing. Most people's attitudes are fixed by age 20 or 25, and rarely change the rest of their lives. I'm not interested in 1,000-year-old communists. Thank you very much." Me, I'm 66, and death is my constant companion. and a very good friend he is. He makes every breath and every pain delicious. Now, great comments. Love getting that kind of feedback. First off, on the, you know, people get fixed in their ways and we don't want 1,000-year-old communists around. The image of a 1,000-year-old communist is not terribly pleasant. I have to grant M. Simon kudos for coming up with that one. Because you think about that and you go, yeah, I can see that. Although a 1,000-year-old attach any ideology is going to be pretty irritating when you think about it. But communist was a terrific example to whip up. However, at what age do we want communists to die then, seriously? You know, if we find someone's ideology irritating, what age do you want them dead? And why don't we just start, you know, knocking them off at that age if we really want people dead because their ideology is irritating? It's not really an argument. The second part, the fact that death makes every breath and every pain delicious, well, this is the rationale, right? This is our lives become more meaningful because they end and it becomes that much sweeter and so on. And you know what? I don't tell anyone else that they shouldn't look at their life that way. I think that you know, if that makes it meaningful to you, if that works for you, great. But my response to M. Simon was as follows. I re-quoted, "He makes every breath and every pain delicious." I wrote, "Well, no offense, but I think your pal Death is a class A son of a bitch." And I don't have anything else to say about him. You know, if you want to be friends with him, that's your choice. He's no friend
of
mine.
Here's the thing. If we happen to conquer aging, his buddy Death is still going to be with us, right? I mean, there's always the proverbial bus, you know, that can run us down in the street. And the only thing is we won't have to live in decrepit, aged bodies while waiting for Death to take us, you know? Death will get around to getting us eventually. It might be 400 or 500 years on down the road before you're unlucky enough to have an anvil fall on your head. But you still die at some point from some accident or something. And in the meantime, you get to live in a pretty fancy body there. So hey, let's conquer aging, and you know, Death will still be with us. If the thought that someday this may all end is what makes life sweeter for you, then that'll still be around.
It will still be around because, yeah, I agree. We can cure aging. We can eliminate disease. We can't eliminate the possibility of dying. Death will always be out there as a possibility, and it will always suck, in my opinion. And
we can push him a little farther. We can push that buddy Death just a little further away, and that's there you are.
And, you know, these last two, I think we've – oh, I'm sorry, did you have more on Death?
No, that was it.
I think we've actually hit the last two already. The answer to our environmental problems lie in technological and economic development, and the answer to virtually all of our problems lie in technological and economic development. Now, these get lumped together, but I think we've discussed the environment one sufficiently. I mean, there's this notion that we're outside of nature, and certainly that our technology and our economy – and our society, our civilization, are all sitting outside of nature. And my answer to that is no, they're not. You know, there's show me the line that divides us from nature. We're part of it, and nature is going to fix itself, and we're the tools by which that can happen. And that's really the most likely way for the planet to get cleaned up, for you know, problems that plague humanity to get solved, and certainly for problems that plague the rest of the planet to get solved. But what about virtually all of our problems? Am I overstating the case there? I mean, what about, let me think about, you know, what about people being mean? What about
morality
war
and
cruelty
like
and,
that.
And, yeah, stuff like that?
Well, let's think about, you know, where people, let's say back during the Middle Ages, where life expectancy was, what, about maybe 40, 35 or 40?
Mm-hmm.
Were people more or less mean to one another during that time than they are now? I would submit that people as a whole are doing better now than, you know, morally, ethically, showing empathy to one another, and more accepting of, say, men for, you know, minorities for the majority within the population, things like that. We do a better job at that now than we did then. And I would think that technology that allows us for longer lives and to advance technologically has something to do. That we've had ethically and morally.
The two seem to have gone together in an interesting way. You know,
is it
correlation?
For example,
what's that?
An easy example is the movement away from slavery in this country.
There you go.
It's one of the reasons that this may sound awful to be put this way, but the North could afford the morality to say, you know, slavery is wrong. And the reason they could afford it is because they were in a more industrial-based economy in the North. And does that mean that slavery is not really immoral? Absolutely not. Slavery is extremely immoral. But they were able to reach that conclusion faster than the South, primarily because of technological development in the North.
That's right. With Thuris in the chat room is saying, sorry to be a downer, but I think we'll need a lot of commitment and backbone and determination and thoughtfulness and even selflessness to get where we're going, not just buckets of tech. And I think, Stephen, what you're saying is that we've already got those tendencies, and the technology enables it. It's not that technology makes us better. It lets us be better. And ultimately, I think people want to be nice. As strange as that might sound, and actually now I'm being the one subtle and counterintuitive, right? But there seems to be a tendency towards niceness with appalling, horrible counterexamples throughout history, and certainly the last century, some of the most shocking and terrible ones that can be named. We've looked at the stats, and statistically, in the 20th century, you were less likely to be killed by another human being than, say, 10,000 years earlier. Hunter-gatherers were killing each other.
That's with two world wars. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's with all the, genocides and everything else occurring during that century. So, yes, there was a tendency for technology to be put in the service of our basest nature, but also this really interesting phenomenon of as we get more capable, and as we have more affluence, as we have more abundance, we seem to be letting go of each other, letting each other have more freedom, and starting to treat each other with the beginnings of respect and in some instances the kind of kindness that that people need to show each other. And there's pockets of the world where that's done heavily, and pockets where it's not caught on at all, and a lot of gray area in between. But I think that's where we're headed. What's that?
Yeah. We are out of time. That probably should be the last word.
All right. Well, then what's our music, Stephen?
The Grass is Always Greener by Janine Wilson.
All right. Well, we've got The Grass is Always Greener by Janine Wilson. We'll be back again next week at the regular time. Stephen, thanks for putting the music together and for all your contributions. Thanks to everyone in the chat room, everyone listening live, and everyone part of Fast Forward Radio. Until next week, live to see it.
Sorry about that.